years, we have heard that the future holds only two certainties, death and taxes. But today's guest says this is a dangerous misconception that can get us into trouble and get us into trouble fast. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I am pleased to introduce to you Daniel Burris, who is a global innovation expert, a leading futurist, and a strategic advisor. The New York Times has referred to Mr. Burris as one of the top three business gurus in the highest demand as a speaker. Daniel Burris, welcome to Mind Talk. Now, Daniel, I have to tell you that I am fascinated as I was reading your latest creation, The Anticipatory Organization, Turn Disruption and Change into Opportunity and Advantage. I became fascinated by the way you think about things. What would you say were your early experiences or influencers that started you along the path you walk today?
Well, over the years, I've started six companies, and I'm happy to say five were profitable in the first year, and four were national leaders in the first year. And I did all of that because I started out, before doing all that, as a teacher teaching biology and physics. And I was always interested in the future, since that's where we're going to spend the rest of our life. And I had started a number of companies after leaving teaching because I had some ideas. Turns out they were good, but you know what? I missed the teaching part. I think the two most important moments in a human's life is the day you're born, the day you find out why you were born. I was lucky to find out long ago I was put on the planet to teach. And that's why I'm excited to be with you today. So back in the early 80s, I started my main company, and we developed a way of looking at the future that has been right. And this is book number seven. I've given thousands of speeches, and I've got a methodology that lets you turn that invisible future into the visible. So I appreciate you giving me a chance to share that with our listeners today.
Well, again, I'm just really appreciative not only of the way you think, but the way you commit your thoughts to paper, the way you express yourself. It's so understandable, if you will. I mean, you're talking about concepts that people very often haven't given a thought to at all. You're raising questions that people typically, if they raise them at all, they have a pat answer and then they go on to the next thing. But the way that you bring your theories and your information to people is really, I think, so makes it so available to folks. It's not a scary entree into a different way of thinking at all. With your model, you talk about anticipation as being critical. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, nowadays we are in a, I would suggest, state of really celebrating the concept of mindfulness, right? You want to keep your focus, you want to keep your attention right where you are, right in the moment, not in the future, but right in the moment. And yet you talk about the value and the energy behind anticipatory thinking, developing anticipatory skills. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, Pamela, thank you so much, because that is actually opening up a fundamental principle that I've been teaching for way over 30 years and is a core to this new book. And that is the concept of future view. How your kids, how your family, how your employees, how we all view the future to a great extent shapes how we act in the present. For example, right now there are people that are buying Apple stock, there are people that are selling Apple stock. The difference? They have a different future view of Apple. Right now there are some kids that are thinking of going to college, other kids are thinking of going to drugs. It's their future view. And you might have employees that are good employees that are thinking of leaving. And the reason is their future view of staying has changed. In other words, how you view the future actually affects how you, how you view the present, how you act in the present. And by the way, how you act in the present will shape your future. So here's the thought. Your future view will determine the future you. And And I believe that most of us have a future view that is based on the past, not the future, because we're at a unique point in human history, a true inflection point we've never been at before, and most of us are kind of not noticing, other than we're seeing all these problems and issues. What I want you to do is to see the amazing opportunity for everyone right now.
One of the points that you make in the book, and part of why I appreciate how readable and understandable it is that not only is this a book for corporations, if you will, or for businesses, but this is a book for the everyday human being. I see the skills that you bring to bear, as we will talk today, are something that is useful not only for the corporate executive, but perhaps for the stay-at-home dad who hasn't got a clue as to what he needs to do next. So again, I have to thank you for that. You begin Anticipatory Organization with some really thought-provoking questions that include identifying businesses that we all know about, but perhaps we didn't think about in the way that you propose. You raise the specter of Uber. How did it become so popular? What is it about Apple that literally when it came on the scene, it practically blew up the scene? The world was forever changed. What should we understand? What should we think about with these companies who seem to pop up? Nobody was really expecting them, but there they are, and now they're marching on to take over the universe.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I would say is one of those provocative questions is, why didn't a cab driver think of Uber? Why didn't Marriott or Hyatt or Hilton think of Airbnb? And the reason is they were all very busy doing what they've always done. And I think that you don't have to be an Einstein or a Bill Gates or a Steve Jobs or a Mark Zuckerberg to be able to really create and shape an amazing future. Matter of fact, you don't have to be rich. Many of the ones I just mentioned didn't start out with a lot of money. What you need to be is not reactionary, crisis managing, putting out fires, reacting to change after it occurs. Actually, all of the great leaders, if you really look at a commonality, were anticipatory. They did what I'm teaching people to do, and they were looking at the what I call the hard trends. Those are the trends that will happen, that are shaping the future, so that they have certainty in a seemingly uncertain world, allowing them to have the confidence to make a bold move. And you don't have to be a genius to do that. You need a methodology. And as you so kindly said, this is not a difficult methodology. It's just a new way to think. But it's a way to think that I think at this point in time is really essential for us.
But you mentioned Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. And, of course, who hasn't heard of both? But, you know, you made the point that he chose to turn down, when Yahoo offered him $1 billion to buy Facebook, he turned it down. Is that an example of just incredible self-esteem, of lots of hope? What is that an example of? How does that fit into the way that you would like for us all to think?
Well, I can very easily see why you have a very popular show. You ask really great questions. I thank you for that. And that means you're very smart as well.
Well, thank you.
and that is a great question, because here was that young guy, and he was really young, and he was offered $1 billion. And let's face it, if somebody was even giving you $1 million as a young guy, you'd probably be pretty well set. But $1 billion, you know, you never have to work a day in your life. And he turned it down. And that isn't because he had a big, overblown ego, although he might have a pretty good ego. It wasn't that he was just full of young hope. He could see the future with confidence. He could see the hard trends shaping the future. And that's what gives us the confidence to move forward. And let me take a second to just talk about that, because I think it's part of the mindset that I'm trying to help us to create. And that is, if the future is completely uncertain. And it does seem, Pamela, right now that we are in an amazingly uncertain point in human history. What's going to happen with taxes? What's going to happen with health care? What's going to happen with the stock market? What's going to happen in the Middle East? What's going to happen with North Korea? We have all of this uncertainty. And when it comes to personal or business strategy, strategy based on uncertainty has high risk. So I teach that the opposite often works better. So instead of looking at all the things I'm uncertain about, which doesn't even empower me at all, and wouldn't have helped Mark Zuckerberg at all, instead you have to ask, what am I certain about? Is it more than death and taxes? And the answer is, oh, there's thousands and thousands of things that you can be absolutely certain about. I call them our trends. And when you have certainty, that's what gives you the confidence to turn down $1 billion as a young man. And again, we can do that too. A very quick example, just so that people listening know what I talk about, it's not too abstract. That's the teacher in me coming out now. And that is one of the hard trends that is based on a future fact is demographics. It's only three, actually. It's not that hard. In demographics, there are in this country 78 million baby boomers. Hard trend. They're going to get older. They're not going to get younger. They're going to get older. And we can predict then with accuracy all kinds of opportunities as well as problems. Just like one of the other categories of hard trends is technology. Our smartphones are trends. They're going to get smarter. And we're going to put more in the cloud. The cloud's not going to disappear or get full. And after 4G wireless and 5G wireless, if that is, now you can safely predict we'll have 6G, followed by 7G, and even know how powerful they'll be. And will there be more government regulation, even if you've got a government that doesn't like regulation? And the answer is, yes, there will be. So when you start looking at all of the things you can be certain about, you can actually, and then you apply it to an offer for $1 billion, and you start realizing, you know what, that's not paying me enough. This is worth far more than $1 billion. Make a good move.
I can see how technology could be one of the hard trends categories, and I can certainly see how demographics could be one of those hard trends. Although, you know, you've just ruined the lives of many people when you said people who are whatever the age they are today, they're definitely going to be older tomorrow. A lot of people didn't want to hear that, so thank you very much for that. But when it comes to government regulation, how does that fit into the concept of a hard trend? I mean, you're saying that no matter what the politicians of yesterday, today, or tomorrow say, do, or try to do, that regulations will increase. How can you say that is a hard fact?
Well, again, it doesn't sound logical, but in a minute I'm going to show you how it is logical. Remember, you can't predict everything. So uncertainty doesn't empower me. So can you accurately predict that all of the regulations that we'll get? Well, no. But that's what's important here is you can definitely predict many that you will get and find advantage in them. For example, regardless of whether whoever the president is, our current president or our future president, if they don't like regulations, will we get more regulations around cybersecurity? The answer is, oh, yes, of course we will.
I see.
Why is that? Because there are some hard trends at play that go beyond an opinion and whether somebody likes something or doesn't that we're going to have to deal with as a society. Right now, there is no law saying how big a drone can be that I could create. In other words, you know, I could create a drone as big as a 747 and fly it around in my backyard. You know, at some point, we're going to say, you know what, you can't make drones if you're unless you're a company with special under what? Special regulations to be able to make something that big. So, you know, we're going to get all kinds of new regulations that you can predict, and then again, some I can't predict. But more importantly, and that is, how do you see an opportunity in regulations? And let me give you a perfect example of how a young person did just that. In California, in January, there were over 1,000 new regulations that came out last January. By the way, we're probably going to get a similar number not unusual for California. And one of the actual laws that came out was a law that said within 3 years, all of the kindergartners and first graders in the state of California, within 3 years, half of their reading has to be nonfiction. By the way, Pamela, right now it's all fiction. The little engine that's doing it is fiction. So you got 3 years to make half of the reading nonfiction. Now, when you hear things like that, you get upset. You start thinking, what are they doing? Don't they have any brains? Why are they spending time on that? But that won't get you anywhere. One of the principles I teach in the book is opposites work better. So instead of looking at what you don't like, look at what you do like. And a 27-year-old teacher in San Diego saw that law, made 3 phone calls. He called the San Diego School District, San Francisco School District, the L.A. School District, and said, hey, you've got 3 years to get half the reading material for those little kids to be nonfiction. If I supply those books, would you be interested? And they all said, wow, we didn't know how we could do that. Of course we're interested. Make a long story short, they underwrote her company and became guaranteed customers, and she didn't have to go on Shark Tank. In other words, if you follow the principles of the anticipatory organization, even if you're a school teacher, and what I mean by that is you're probably not making a lot of money. You could even start a very big company without having to get financial backers. Because I teach everyone in the book how you can do far more than you ever dreamed, even, in this case, from government regulation.
Interesting. So what's the difference between a soft trend and a hard trend?
Well, that's really good. There's only 2 types of trends. It's either no shortage of trends. Matter of fact, we're coming up on a new year, and as you might guess, there's going to be a whole bunch of trends published in all the newspapers and all the magazines. The trouble is, which ones are going to happen? So this is a proven methodology of easily separating the wheat from the chaff, the ones that will from the ones that might. So a hard trend is based on a future fact. It will happen. You can't stop it. But the good news is you can see it coming ahead of time. And that's how you can turn change and disruption into opportunity. Because it hasn't happened yet. You know it's going to happen. And now you have some choices. In the case of disruption, you now can either be the disrupted and just let it happen, or become the disruptor and create positive disruption. And change. In the case of soft trends, they're not based on a future fact. They're based on an assumption of the future. And unfortunately, a lot of people think that those assumptions are bad. But the beautiful thing about a hard trend is you can see it before it happens. And if you can predict the future accurately before it happens, you do have an advantage. And a soft trend, if you don't like it, you can change it. Let me just give you a very quick example to bring this to life. And that is, with a soft trend, I was speaking about 2 weeks ago to a large healthcare conference in the United States. There were about 2,000 CEOs of hospitals and other drug companies and so on. And before I gave my keynote speech and introduced this concept, they were all thinking, like most Americans, that the cost of healthcare is going to just continue to go up. In other words, they think that's a hard trend future fact. But in reality, that's a soft trend. Now, if you think it's a hard trend, you want to try to change it.
Daniel, let me do this.
Yes.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, you've just said, again, something that I know folks are saying, what is he talking about? Because all we ever hear is that healthcare is going up, that the expenses are going up. So when we come back, I'd like to start with your letting us know what you told these healthcare executives about the future and healthcare. Folks, stay where you are. We will be right back. things that we have been hearing about healthcare, and we've been hearing a whole bunch, there has been one constant. Healthcare expenses are going to go up. And yet, you're saying that in front of a group of thousands of healthcare experts, you told them something quite different. What did you tell them?
I told them that the even though a trend is healthcare has been going up, 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 as we all know, for actually over a decade, the reality is that it's a soft trend, and you can change it, or you can assume it's a hard trend and let it happen. So to make this real for our listeners, I'm going to give you an exact way that you can change it. One is there is a technology called blockchain. I'm not going to get into the details of that now. And if you'd like to learn more on that, you can also go to my website and read about it. But blockchain enables you to create a purchasing supply chain that is transparent. And transparency, by the way, brings trust. It is more secure, and it works at a lower cost. So what I'm getting at here is that right now, if you're in a hospital, you probably don't realize how much that aspirin costs. And I think some of us have read about how in a hospital an aspirin can cost you $30. But you don't know that. It's not transparent. And if you need a knee replacement, you don't know how much that knee costs at various hospitals, even if it's the same part, even if it's made by the same company, much less how much it'll cost to put it in. All of it is not transparent right now. With blockchain, you can very easily bring transparency to the healthcare system. That would bring much better competition because it's easy to have way inflated prices when nobody knows what the price is. And we could flush billions of dollars of cost out of our healthcare system. By the way, there's another principle I teach. If it can be done, it will be done. If you don't do it, someone else will. What I'm saying is somebody's going to do that. It'll happen soon. You'll be reading about it, and you're going to say to yourself, wow, I remember that guy on that radio show telling us about that, because that will happen. Here's another one, very quickly, with hospitals. Just if you took technologies that exist today, you don't even need future technologies. If you had technologies like virtualization, the cloud, and other things like that, you could transform purchasing and logistics just within the healthcare network. And you could, once again, flush billions of dollars of waste out very easily. In other words, you could actually bring the cost down. So instead of assuming, let's give you one more healthcare assumption that's really good, and that is low-stake obesity. There was just a report in the news last week about the U.S. doing a study for the year 2025 to see how obese will we all be, including our children, by the way. And as most of us know, over the last 20 years, we've all, the trend has been more and more obesity, which means more and more disease and problems. And the reason the U.S. did that study was to see how are we going to pay for that big obese mess we're going to get in 2025. But once again, that's a soft trend. That's not a future fact. We could change that. And I'll give you an example of a company that did. You may not be able to change it for the world, but here's the thing that's powerful about my book, and that is you can change it for you. And if you have a company for your organization, Manpower is a company that's global. They, 2 years ago, bought Fitbit for all of their employees. They have weekly and monthly contests with prizes. Well, what's happened? They have lost. They're losing weight. They have less sick days. People are getting off their cholesterol medication. People are getting off their high blood pressure medication. In other words, the rest of the world can go ahead and get obese if they want to, but at Manpower, we're not going to. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to get healthier. So the point here is you can change the future if you want to. You see, we can't change the past. The thing I'm excited about the future, you can change the future based on the actions you take in the present.
Does any of this require that you have positive thoughts about yourself, or does that not come into play with this?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that, because I believe that what I'm teaching in this book in reality is a mindset, because if you change your mindset, you can change your results, both personally and beyond. So let's go back to future. If my future is that no matter what I try, I'll fail, or that I'll never be able to do that, then what'll happen? Well, you won't try, and you probably will fail a lot because you've already, that's your mindset. I would like us to change our future view, our view of ourselves in the future, and realize the power of the human mind. It's unbelievably powerful, and most of us tend to coast along. And you know what? It's time to elevate your thinking, because it's amazing what you can do. I have a friend of mine and I, we were both teaching back way back long ago. And I said, I'm going to have a home on a lake, and I'm going to live on the ocean. I'm going to have two homes. By the way, I was making a teacher's salary. No way could I have done that at the moment. And I said, I'm going to do that. The other guy said, well, I'd like to do that, but I'll never be able to do that. Well,
huge difference.
Later,
yeah.
We were both right. I was able to do it. He wasn't.
That's powerful. Absolutely.
You know, we're writing our book of life every day. First of all, why don't you make it a great book? And secondly, if you're starting to write a tragedy, you need a new chapter.
Absolutely. That was in and of itself just such a powerful example of the way that how we think about and talk to ourselves can have a huge impact on, as you said, the future that we create, and we can.
Absolutely, and that's why I was excited to be on your show, because this idea of being anticipatory is extremely powerful. But one of the keys to being anticipatory is learning how to accurately predict problems that you or your organization will have in the future and pre-solve them so you don't have them in the first place. I mean, how many people have said, I knew that was going to happen? My response is, so why did you let it? Most of the problems you'll be having a year or two from now, you can see right now using the techniques that I teach and pre-solve them so you don't have them in the first place. Boy, would that make life nice.
And so, hugely different.
Oh, yeah, because most of us crisis manage our lives. And we just have one thing after another. Uh-oh, there was a shift that happened, and now I'm getting laid off. Again, if you would have been anticipatory, you would have seen that coming down the road and had time to get a little training in the right thing and gotten the job that even paid more before you got laid off. Most of us just wait until the shoe drops. Why? Why are you doing that? When you know the shoe's going to drop anyway. Why don't you take some action before the problem takes place? So this is really a powerful psychological element that I bring into business, because in reality, every organization is made up of humans. And we have time for just a couple of minutes before a break to give you another
absolutely
to how this works.
Absolutely.
Right, good. Thank you. All right. Let's go back to future view, because again, you were talking about the present and how powerful the present is, which, by the way, you're absolutely right. But your future view comes right together with it. Let's take two CEOs. One of them has a large brick-and-mortar chain all over the United States. So this is brick-and-mortar retail, and they have hundreds of stores all over the country. And their future view of brick-and-mortar retail is, after looking at Amazon and all the online stuff, their future view is, well, the good old days of brick-and-mortar retail is behind us. And with that future view, they might close 174 stores. By the way, Sears just did that. That's the future view of that company. On the other hand, if you think to yourself, you know what, the future of brick-and-mortar retail, the good old days are ahead of us. They just don't look like the days that are behind us. You might buy old boots, as Amazon did. You might open 100 brick-and-mortar bookstores, as Amazon is doing all over the country right now. In other words, both of those CEOs have a different view of the future of brick-and-mortar retail. Will those individuals of those companies all experience completely different futures? And you know the answer, don't you? Of course they will. One is closing, and one is diminishing and laying people off like crazy. The other people is hiring people like crazy. what's your future view, listener, right now? I'm talking to you, listener of the show. What is your future view? And I'm going to tell you right now, it's too low. You're going to undershoot because there's so many possibilities right now. It's like a mountain. It's as solid as a mountain, the opportunities ahead for all of us, but it's bogged in by the news because bad news doesn't sell and good news, good news doesn't sell. Bad news sells. And if there's no bad news, of course, they give you the anniversary of bad news. So blow away some of that fog. See the opportunity. Elevate your future view. And I'm telling you, you're going to have a much better future.
For those people who are listening and are becoming more and more excited about the shift in thinking that you propose, how important is it for them to surround themselves with like-minded or willing to be like-minded people?
Well, I think that's, again, we can see your expertise coming through here, and that is important. You've got to take a look at, are the people that are around you pulling you down or helping lift you up? Because you aren't going to stay in one place. You know, things happen to us. Sometimes bad things happen to us. And when something happens to us, you're either going to go down or you're going to go up, but you won't stay neutral. And that is a choice. You do have some choices. And you have choices in your friends. You have some choices in people around you. So if you're with toxic people, you're going to end up living a toxic life. Is that really the life that you want? So I think what we have to do is be concerned about, are the people around us helping me thrive and grow, or are they pulling me back and pulling me down? Pay attention to that. Re-examine that. You know, there's an old statement, if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always had. But I'm going to change that statement. If you do what you've always done today, you're going to get less of what you've always had. Why? Because the world is changing fast. Are you?
Excellent question. Excellent way for folks to begin to shift how they're thinking about themselves and about their future. You know, as we proceed with our conversation, yes, the book is entitled The Anticipatory Organization, but as you've so clearly stated, this shift in thinking is actually what, in my world as a psychotherapist, when you can shift from what happened yesterday to what the possibilities are for tomorrow, you're shifting over to health. You're opening yourselves up to more energy and quite frankly, in all likelihood, being more of the person you are and certainly more of the person you were meant to be. So the book, again, looks like it may be written for an organization, but it is clearly for the people, quite frankly, who make up the organization.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, you got to focus on the subtitle, and that is how to turn disruption and change into opportunity and advantage. And you're going to be getting more change and more disruption. Why not learn how to make that an opportunity? That's really what I'm trying to do.
And again, even using the term disruption, you know, nowadays, for the most part, many of us think, oh, gosh, disruption, terrible thing. A disruptor, oh, bad person. You've turned that around completely.
Yeah, that's really an important point. You know why people and companies, by the way, think disruption is a bad thing? It's because you're letting it happen to you. And when things happen to you and disrupt your job, disrupt your career, disrupt your business, of course you think, oh, I got to change. But after the fact, and it caught you by surprise. In this case, I'm saying the way to turn disruption into something that's positive is to see the forces that are shaping and creating disruption before they hit and use them to create positive disruption. In other words, I would like all of our listeners to be positive disruptors. Positive disruptors. In other words, if you want a more human, connected future, if you want a more enlightened future, if you want a better future, hope isn't the strategy. You got to get moving. You got to get shaping. You know, you can't change the past, as I said earlier. You can learn from it. I like learning from it, but you can't change it. And surely you don't want it to be an anchor holding you back. Instead, why I'm so excited about the future, because, again, you can, every day, you get a choice what that future is for you. And if you change your future view, you'll change the future you.
And I have to say that there's just a way that you speak about this that is almost infectious. So even for those listening who may have entered into our conversation thinking, yeah, well, crystal ball, who cares? At this point in our conversation, I would suspect that you've already altered or shifted the path that people are thinking along. And that is quite a gift that you have that you're sharing with people.
Well, you know, thank you. And the book is far more than just trends and looking at the future. There's a number, as you know, because you looked at the book and read some of it, that, you know, for example, one of the parts of the book, I talk about how to take your biggest problem and skip it.
Yes.
And the skip it principle is a very powerful principle. And there are many powerful principles in this book. As I mentioned, opposites working better. And frankly, I love all of them. The skipping principle I use all the time. Really useful.
Well, we're going to take a break in a moment, but when we come back, I want you to tell us about the skip it principle, and I want you to tell us about this notion that failing slow is expensive, and the best thing you can do is just hurry up and fail quick and then move on. So we've still got lots to talk about. We're going to take a break in just a moment, folks. I'm speaking with Daniel Burris, who is the author of The Anticipatory Organization, Turn Disruption and Change into Opportunity and Advantage. And this book also includes 25 proven strategies to accelerate innovation and transform results. So clearly the contents is something that, as you've heard me say repeatedly, is something that will feed everyone. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Is the skip it principle? Sounds kind of intriguing.
Well, the skip it principle is really powerful, and again, I use it all the time. One of the things I would suggest is think right now, and I want to talk to your listeners, think of your biggest problem you've got right now. Think of it, and by the way, it doesn't take long for that to come up. I hear something I'd like you to do. I'd like you to realize that's not it. You see, you can skip that. What I've found over the years is the problem that you're working on, the reason you're stuck on it is you've defined the problem. It's not the right problem. There's a different, there's another underlying problem, and you learn how to peel the onion back and get to the real problem, you can easily solve it, move forward fast. You're stuck because you're working on the wrong one. Let me give you a couple of quick examples to make this real for our listeners. And again, as you can tell, the teacher in me doesn't like to just give a concept. It's the story behind it that helps me bring it to life. So here's a simple example. One of my nieces, Callie, called me recently, and she said that she's got her first job. She's making money now for the first time. And she's saying, Uncle Dan, I can't save money. I'm trying really, really hard to save money, but no matter what I do, I can't save it. And by the way, Callie knows it's possible because her older sister, Audrey, has had a job, and she could save money like crazy. Allie, it just goes on. She just can't save money. And she said, I'm working really hard at saving money, but I just can't save it. And I said, well, that's because you're working on the wrong problem. Actually, you got to work on how you spend your money instead of trying to save it. You got to work on how you spend it. If you spend it differently, you'll save it by default. You see, and by the way, that's an opposite. Let me give you another example.
Okay.
I'm just saying okay. Yeah, so that's as simple as that. Let me give you another bigger one. I was talking to the CEO of a major drug company a number of years ago. I asked him, what's your biggest problem? And you already know, I knew ahead of time, whatever he said, that wasn't it. Hey, he's got Nobel laureates to work for him. He's got PhDs to work for him. You mean he can't solve a problem? Give me a break. Remember, problems you couldn't solve once you knew what the real problem was. So I said, what's your biggest problem? And he said, we got to hire about 2,000 PhD researchers, but they're very expensive, and I don't have the budget for it. But it's really important. That's my biggest problem. Well, I knew that wasn't it. So I said, I started to peel the onion back by asking why. Why do you need those 2,000 researchers? And he said, well, our company stock price, and that's where our money comes from, is worth, its value is determined by how many drugs are in the pipeline. To get drugs in the pipeline, you got to solve molecular problems. To solve molecular problems, you need researchers. Right now, our pipeline is low. Our stock price is down. And we figure we need at least 2,000 more researchers to get our pipeline built up. But because it's down, I don't have the budget. That's my problem. So I said, okay, well, then let's get that. And he kind of laughed. And we always laugh when somebody says something like that because we would love to do it, but we think it's impossible. But actually, it can. Here's what I said. Why don't you take all of your molecular problems and put them on the internet in a dozen languages and say, hey, we pay for solutions. Well, they did that. And it didn't take long, and they had thousands and thousands and thousands of PhD researchers from all over the world submitting solutions. And this company was called Eli Lilly, purchased the solutions they wanted to purchase. And their stock price went back up. In other words, was the problem he couldn't afford the 2,000 researchers? No, he thought that was the problem, but that wasn't the problem. And there was a much better solution once he freed himself of that's the problem. Whatever your problem is, that's not it. One other real quick example, I happened to be watching the History Channel, and they were talking about after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, we knew we were going to have to, we're going to win the war, we're going to have to invade Japan. And there were hundreds of islands between Hawaii and Japan that were occupied by the Japanese. And the strategy at first was we got to retake all of them on the way to Japan, which, by the way, would have cost millions of lives on both sides. Until someone said, no, let's get that. Let's get that. Why don't we just draw a straight line from Hawaii to Japan and retake just the islands in that path? And leave the other ones occupied by Japan. Who cares? You know what? That saved millions of lives. That is another example of skipping.
It's a fascinating way to just turn things around, to look for the possible versus allowing yourself to be mired in the impossible.
Yes, and the real key here is the problem that you have is either two or three problems combined into one, and that's why you can't solve it. In the book, I talk about how to get it down to one. For example, you might say, my kid can't read and is not getting along with the other kids in school. Well, that's two problems. You can't solve those with one solution. You can break them into two different problems with two different solutions. And then secondly, what's the real problem? Why are you not getting along with others? Why are you having trouble with reading? So you can get down to what the real problem is so you can solve it. You know, once again, as you said in the beginning of this interview, the principles are actually quite simple, but they're actually quite powerful.
Talk about your belief that failing slow is expensive.
Yes, well, if you, and let's go back to hard trends and disruption to even play this out. And that is, did someone long ago say, hey, let's not tell Kodak about digital photography, let's keep that a secret? You and I both know, no, Kodak knew about digital photography in the beginning. they saw it as a soft trend, a fad. So instead, they protected and defended their chemical-based photography. Oops. Bad. They didn't realize it was a hard trend. They didn't know about this. But that's why I'm sharing it in the book. And so what did Kodak do? Well, for decades, they protected and defended the old way of doing things. In other words, they failed slowly. And I don't like failing slowly. It's too expensive. I don't have time for failing slowly. I want to fail quickly so that I can learn quickly. You see, our biggest lessons in life do not come from our successes. Here's an insight for you. The biggest successes, the biggest insights come from our failures. So when you have a problem, when you have a failure, always ask yourself, what did I learn from? And because some of us don't, we just go keep failing. And instead, no, what are you learning from? Because if you can learn from that mistake, because we all make mistakes, and if you can fail quickly, and then what does that mean? You learn faster, too. So learn from your mistakes, fail fast. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, I started 6 companies, and 5 were profitable in the first year, and 4 were national leaders in the first year. How did I do that? I didn't even start out with any money. I was a teacher in the beginning. The answer is, I learned how to fail fast. Because I couldn't afford to fail slow. And then, secondly, I looked at the hard trends that were shaping the future that were going to happen anyway, so that I could make bold moves with confidence and certainty. And the last little thing I'll share is I didn't compete, because I don't like to compete. It's too hard. The more you look at your competition, the more you act like them, the more you compete with them, and the more your margins are low. What I would like you to do is to not imitate, but to innovate and to do what I'm talking about, which is far easier.
You acknowledge that businesses, organizations, all kinds of businesses, all kinds of people, we're all familiar with the notion of a postmortem, but you say, let's do a premortem. Walk me through that.
Yeah, well, you know, you do when you do something, let's say you have a new sales process, or you've got a new display, or you're manufacturing, you're making some new product, or let's say that you tried something and it didn't work. A postmortem is let's review what we did so that we can learn from our mistakes and not have that happen again. Which I think, by the way, is a good idea. But I suggest doing a premortem instead. A premortem says before you introduce that new thing, you try that new thing, ask yourself, what will cause it to fail? Let's brainstorm all the ways that this won't work, and then let's pre-solve all of those problems so that none of them happen in the first place. That's the way I was able to run up and do such a good job with all those companies so quickly. I did premortems. So that I built success into it right up front by pre-solving all the predictable problems instead of what most of us do, and that is wait for the problem to happen and then do a post-mortem to figure out, you know, what did we learn from it. I'd rather not have the problem in the first place. Try pre-mortems. You'll love it.
What's time travel auditing? I don't get it.
That's a really good one. And actually, I know you're going to like this one especially. We all have different perspectives. Some people are past-oriented, some people are present-oriented, and some people are future-oriented. A past-oriented person thinks the good old days are behind them, the future looks bleak to them, they don't even like how the future looks, the whole world is going downhill. They still may have a flip phone, they don't like new technology, and all that. There are present-oriented people. And, you know, they kind of get, if their company says we need to have smartphones, they go ahead and get a smartphone because the company said we needed to get one, and they're okay with it. They don't fight it. There are future-oriented people. They're the people that are buying all the new stuff with their own money because they can't wait. The future looks great for them. It's just not happening fast enough. So here's an interesting thing. It's good to know where people are in time mentally. So let's say that I'm a future-oriented person, and I'm trying to sell to a past-oriented person. The past-oriented person is going to say, oh, you're way too far out there. You know, you don't understand me, and you're probably going to hunker down and not buy anything. By the way, let's reverse that. What if I'm a past oriented person. The truth is that that potential customer who's future oriented is going to say, wow, this person's out of touch. They don't even know what's going on. I'm not going to buy something from them. What else don't they know? So it's important. And by the way, think about parents talking to kids. The parent might be past oriented, the kid might be future oriented. No wonder you're disconnected at the dinner table. So if we do a little time travel audit, the key is once you learn where the other person is, jump into their time zone with them. And you can walk them along. You can relate to them. You can increase your communications. You can increase your collaboration. And you can get yourself moving forward. By the way, this is also true of companies. Some companies are past. Some companies are future. It's true of teams. Some teams are led by people that think the good old days are behind them. Some people think the good old days are ahead. So do a little time travel audit. And it's amazing what you can do with moving everyone forward fast.
So if you're a future-oriented person and I'm a history-oriented person, I've got my flip phone and I love it. It's safe. It's secure. I don't have to worry about being... I just love my flip phone. Why are you, future-oriented person, trying to sell me that fancy, expensive smartphone? How are you going to sell that to me?
And I've done that many times as just examples, but I was at a conference recently, and I was told that there was a person at the meeting who was an executive who was just like you described, with phone, astro-oriented, future looks bleak, but he's very smart, had a lot of good history, had done many great innovative things, but he was kind of holding the organization back because he hadn't retired yet, and he was kind of stuck in the past. So they had this problem. And so I went over, and I talked to him a little bit, and I actually used the smartphone, flip phone thing as an example. And I talked to him, and I asked him what he'd like to do, and he said he likes to golf, and, he loves to talk to his grandkids. And I said, just talking to your grandkids is pretty good, but how'd you like to see them when you talk to them? Because it turns out they weren't in the same city. They didn't even live in the same state. How would you like to actually see them and see that sparkle in their eye when you talk to them each time? And it doesn't cost you anything. It's actually free. And he said, that'd be great. I said, well, actually, you can do that with a smartphone. And I showed him very quickly. I can quickly do that very easily. And I said, you like to golf? How would you like to be able to get a tee time set up anytime you want, right from your phone? How would you like to take them to the green and see if it's the kind of golf course you like? And he said, oh, yeah, that would be kind of cool. Now, hey, let me just that app is free. Get one of them. In other words, it didn't take long, and he said, I need a smartphone. And by the way, he got one. The other thing, though, is I started helping him get excited about the future because he was using his past perspective to look at the future, and that's why it looked bleak. So let's get to how can you do this. Let's say I'm going to be selling a heating and air conditioning system to your home. I'm a salesperson, let's say I'm future-oriented. Let's say you're the potential customer, and I'm knocking on your door. I'm going to bring in my three-ring binder with all the normal old stuff that you would show a client when you're showing them new heating and air conditioning systems, but I'm also going to bring my iPad. And when I walk in, I'm going to notice your past-oriented. It doesn't take long, you can tell if someone is that way. So what am I going to start with? I'm going to jump into your time zone with you. I'm going to bring out the pictures and the three-ring binder because, you're comfortable with that. And then I'm going to say somewhere along the line, I've got this new iPad, and it's got a way to show you your house in like a three-dimensional, beautiful, cool thing with the different air conditioning systems I have. And it's really cool. Would you like to see it? Now, what are they doing? We're getting permission to take you into the future. See, people don't like to be yanked into the future, but they will come with permission. I'm giving you a quick example of how you can walk people into the future. And by the way, you can do that in any. I teach all of that in the book.
And so, just with those examples, what you're showing us is it's not a Herculean task to help people move from one perspective to another. It takes awareness, it takes thoughtfulness, maybe a little mindfulness, and you can do exactly the things that you're talking about in the anticipatory organization. Daniel, I am so sorry to say that our time is just about left us today, but one of the things that you say in your book that I would like to close our conversation is your recommendation that people choose to be extraordinary, because we can.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've done a study of extraordinary people over history, and some of them were born that way, but the reality is most were not born that way. They were ordinary, and at some point in their life, they started doing extraordinary things. Mother Teresa, when she was 12 years old, didn't run around as a little kid saying, I'm going to grow up and be Mother Teresa. Actually, she started out as an ordinary nun, and then all of a sudden started doing extraordinary things and became an extraordinary nun. It's a choice. So to be extraordinary is a daily choice. Let's say you're a student and you're about to ask the question in class. Before you ask the question, wait a second, ask yourself, what would an extraordinary student ask? Ask that question instead.
Great exercise.
Yeah, it's a great exercise. As a matter of fact, as we're running toward the end here, I've done something special for your listeners just for you, Pamela, and because I knew I'd enjoy being on your show. I'm actually going to give all of our listeners today a free hardcover copy of the book, a hardcover copy. And all they have to do is go to theaobook.com, and it's a couple bucks for shipping. And I'm actually going to, that's my little Christmas present, you're going to get a hardcover copy, because I'm skipping the problem of you saying, I don't want to buy it. You know what? I'm just
going
to give it to you.
Daniel, thank you so much for that. This has been a delightful time. Please give folks your web address.
My website is burrus.com. I have a lot of goodies for you. And again, if you want to get that book, you can go to Amazon or any bookstore there, at Barnes & Noble, or all over. But if you want, you can go to theaobook.com. And I'll just give you a hardcover copy. There you go.
Well, Daniel, again, I have to thank you so much. And I just have to sneak in a comment about the magazine that you do, because I was absolutely thrilled by that. Got to say so long. But again, thank you very much for your time today and for all the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So do send an email to me at Pamela@mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.